but I also knew that might trigger my body to stiffen up and shut down. I was fighting two fires at once and didn't know where to strike first. I opted to stay on the minute-by-minute pace and in between experimented with different solutions. I wore two pairs of gloves, then three. I resorted to my old friend, duct tape. Didn't help. I couldn't wrap the bar in pads because that was against Guinness rules. All I could do was try anything and everything to stay in the fight. 10 hours into the attempt, I hit a wall. I was down to three pull-ups a minute on the minute. The pain was excruciating, and I needed some relief. I took my right glove off. Layers of skin came off with it. My palm looked like raw hamburger. My mom called a doctor friend, Regina, who lived nearby, and the two of us went into the back room to wait for her and try to salvage my record attempt. When Regina showed up, she evaluated the situation, pulled out a syringe, loaded it with local anesthetic, and dipped the needle toward the open wound on my right hand. She looked over. My heart pounded. Sweat saturated every inch of my skin. I could feel my muscles cooling down and stiffening up, but I nodded, turned away, and she sunk that needle in deep. It hurt so fucking bad, but I held my primal scream inside. Show no weakness remained my motto, but that didn't mean I felt strong. My mom pulled off my left glove, anticipating the second shot, but Regina was busy examining the swelling in my biceps and the bulging spasms in my forearms. "You look like you're in rhabdomyolysis, David," she said. "You shouldn't continue. It's dangerous." I had no idea what the fuck she was talking about, so she broke it down. There's a phenomenon that happens when one muscle group has worked way too hard for way too long. The muscles become starved of glucose and break down, leaking myoglobin, a fibrous protein that stores oxygen in the muscle, into the bloodstream. When that happens, it's up to the kidneys to filter all those proteins out, and if they become overwhelmed, they shut down. People can die from rhabdo, she said. My hands throbbed with agony. My muscles were locking up, and the stakes couldn't be higher. Any rational person would have thrown in the towel, but I could hear going the distance booming from the speakers. I knew that this was my 14th round, cut me, Mick, moment. Fuck rationality. I held up my left palm and had Regina sink her needle in. Waves of pain washed through me as a bumper crop of doubt flowered in my mind. She wrapped both palms in layers of gauze and medical tape and fitted me with a fresh pair of gloves. Then I stalked back out onto the gym floor and got back to work. I was at 2,900, and as long as I remained in the fight, I still believed anything was possible. I did sets of twos and threes on the minute for 2 hours, but it felt like I was gripping a red-hot melting rod, which meant I was down to using my fingertips to grip the bar. First, I used four fingers, then three. I was able to gut out 100 more pull-ups, then 100 more. Hours ticked by. I crept closer, but with my body in rhabdo, breakdown was imminent. I did several sets of pull-ups with my wrists dangling over the bar. It sounds impossible, but I managed until the numbing agent stopped working. Then even bending my fingers felt like I was stabbing myself in the hand with a sharp knife. After eclipsing 3,200 pull-ups, I worked out the math and realized if I could do 800 sets of one, it would take 13 hours and change to break the record, and I would just beat the clock. I lasted 45 minutes. The pain was too much, and the vibe in the room went from optimistic to somber. I was still trying to show as little weakness as I could, but the volunteers could see me messing with my gloves and grip and knew something was drastically wrong. When I went into the back to regroup a second time, I heard a collective sigh that sounded like doom. Regina and my mother unwrapped the tape on my hands, and I could feel my flesh peeling like a banana. Both palms were filleted open down to the dermis, which is where our nerves lie. Achilles had his heel, and when it came to pull-ups, my gift and my undoing were my hands. The doubters were right. I wasn't one of those lightweight, graceful pull-up guys. I was powerful, and the power came from my grip, but now my hand better resembled a physiology mannequin than something human. Emotionally, I was wasted, not just because of my sheer physical exhaustion or because I couldn't get the record for myself, but because so many people had come out to help. I'd taken over Nandor's gym and felt like I disappointed everyone. Without a word, my mother and I slipped out the back door like we were escaping a crime scene. And as she drove to the hospital, I couldn't stop thinking, I'm better than this. While Nandor and his team broke down the clocks, untied the banners, swept up chalk, and peeled bloody tape off their pull-up bar, my mom and I slumped into chairs in the ER waiting room. I was holding what was left of my glove. It looked like it was lifted from the O.J. Simpson crime scene, like it had been marinated in blood. She eyeballed me and shook her head. "Well," she said, "I know one thing." After a long pause, I turned to face her. "What's that?" "You're going to do this again." She read my damn mind. I was already doing my live autopsy and would run through a complete AAR on paper as soon as my bloody hands would allow. I knew there was treasure in this wreckage and leverage to be gained somewhere. I just had to piece it together like a puzzle. And the fact that she realized that without my saying so fired me up. A lot of us surround ourselves with people who speak to our desire for comfort, who would rather treat the pain of our wounds and prevent further injury than help us callous over them and try again. We need to surround ourselves with people who will tell us what we need to hear, not what we want to hear, but at the same time, not make us feel we're up against the impossible. My mother was my biggest fan. Whenever I failed in life, she was always asking me when and where I would go after it again. She never said, "Well, maybe it isn't meant to be." Most wars are won or lost in our own heads. And when we're in a foxhole, we usually aren't alone. And we need to be confident in the quality of the heart, mind, and dialogue of the person hunkered down with us. Because at some point, we will need some empowering words to keep us focused and deadly. In that hospital, in my own personal foxhole, I was swimming in doubt. I fell 800 pull-ups short, and I knew what 800 pull-ups felt like. That's a long fucking day. But there was nobody else I'd rather have been in that foxhole with. "Don't worry," she said. "I'll start calling those witnesses up as soon as we get home." "Roger that," I said. "Tell them I'll be back on that bar in 2 months." I mean, that's a quick turnaround.
Here we go again,
that's
man.
That's a quick turnaround, bro.
It was 2 months from the first time. So my first record was, or my first record attempt was September. Then it was November. And then the next one is in January, man.
That's a quick turnaround. So walk us through that. So how, I mean, you know, I guess there's a lot of places to start. I know that one place to start is after that failure, you had some pretty, you made some people pretty happy.
Oh yeah, man. You know what's funny about life is there's people out there who don't really want to see you succeed. And it's a lot of those people out there who aren't pushing themselves very hard. And like, once again, like I was talking about in the last chapter, those of us who are trying to overachieve and find their very best, you make people feel pretty small about themselves. So your failure makes them feel that much better about themselves. And it's a horrible thing, but it's a very true thing. And I see you up here talking about my hand. Those of you who, you know, you guys aren't buying the actual book, you guys are listening to it, Google David Goggins pull-up hand. And you'll see that disgusting, nasty, third-degree burn I had on that hand. It is filleted open real nice.
That's crazy. And so how long did it take for that wound to heal?
You know what's funny? I healed from that in about 2 weeks.
I mean, that's quick.
So, yeah, I had damaged my body so much through everything I had done that my body realized this guy's going to come back, whether it was running and my legs were broken or whatever happened. My body would heal very fast because it knew he's not going to give us a lot of time to rest. So literally it would heal really fast. So I was back on the pull-up bar in a couple of weeks. And
did it become a callus type streak, or what did it become like?
Yeah, it got like a real big thick callus.
Okay.
So it actually came back even stronger. So it actually came back real strong. And there's another thing that happened during that second pull-up record. A whole mess of doubters came out of the woodwork. And it was, you know what's funny about that? I was trying to break a record of 4,020. Not many people were going for this record, okay? And I had all these people in my ear who probably couldn't even do 10 pull-ups. That's the funny thing about it. There's a ton of armchair quarterbacks out there who are judging you on what you're doing. And that's just, you know, you can't let that stuff get in your head. People, don't listen to anybody who is not trying what you're trying to do or who's not putting forth the effort you're putting forth. Man, you got to really put that stuff out of your head.
But then, you know, at the same time, you started listening to them strategically in certain places because sometimes you could find some some, I guess, a tactical advantage in how they're coming at you.
Exactly. So through all the hate, there were a lot of gifts. There were a lot of gifts throughout the hate. So I actually read it. And, you know, people are talking about hands, talking about this, talking about that. And I took it all into account.
Hmm.
And I ended up going through with it, you know, like, you know, with the fine tooth comb and realized, you know what? Yeah, they're right here. They're right here. So it takes, once again, you know, we talked about it early in the book, thick skin. Some of the, some of the harsh words I heard, they were the truth.
Right.
But we hate hearing the truth. I started loving the truth. Yeah, they were mean, some horrible comments, but in the day, there was a lot of truth in those horrible comments, and I was just getting them and writing them down and putting them on the accountability mirror.
And you were able to focus harder, right?
Much harder.
Yeah.
So I call it putting on the old Bose headphones. Even though I don't have Bose headphones, or at least at that time I didn't have any, but I would literally, like, you know, just like kind of visually put them on. Once I got all the information, I went and did my AARs. I figured it all out. It was time now to stop listening to the noise.
Mm.
And I literally, in my mind, shut it out, put the Bose headphones on, and went to work.
And just like negativity kind of couching some gifts or cloaking some gifts that you can use, failure you've come to look at as a total gift as well, right?
Oh, failure is one of the biggest gifts of all. You know, because in failure, if you can get failure and dissect it, and in failure, you can find out, you know, exactly how to succeed in failure. So to me, it's one of the biggest gifts of life.
In life, there is no gift as overlooked or inevitable as failure. I've had quite a few, and I've learned to relish them, because if you do the forensics, you'll find clues about where to make adjustments and how to eventually accomplish your task. I'm not talking about a mental list either. After the second attempt, I wrote everything out longhand, but didn't start with the obvious issue, my grip. Initially, I brainstormed everything that went well, because in every failure, a lot of good things will have happened, and we must acknowledge them. The best takeaway from the Nashville attempt was Nandor's place. His dungeon of a gym was the perfect environment for me. Yeah, I'm on social media and in the spotlight from time to time, but I am not a Hollywood person. I get my strength from a very dark place, and Nandor's gym wasn't a phony-ass happy factory. It was dark, sweaty, painful, and real. I called him the very next day and asked if I could come back to train and make another run at the record. I'd taken a lot of his time and energy and left behind a mess, so I had no idea how he'd respond. "Yeah, motherfucker," he said. "Let's go." It meant a lot to have his support again. Another positive was how I handled my second meltdown. I was off the mat and on the comeback trail before I even saw the ER doc. That's where you want to be. You can't let a simple failure derail your mission, or let it worm so far up your ass it takes over your brain and sabotages your relationships with people who are close to you. Everyone fails sometimes, and life isn't supposed to be fair, much less bend to your every whim. Luck is a capricious bitch. It won't always go your way, so you can't get trapped in this idea that just because you've imagined a possibility for yourself, that you somehow deserve it. Your entitled mind is dead weight. Cut it loose. Don't focus on what you think you deserve. Take aim on what you are willing to earn. I never blamed anyone for my failures, and I didn't hang my head in Nashville. I stayed humble and sidestepped my entitled mind because I knew damn well I hadn't earned my record. The scoreboard does not lie, and I didn't delude myself otherwise. Believe it or not, most people prefer delusion. They blame others or bad luck or chaotic circumstance. I didn't, which was positive. I listed most of the equipment we used on the positive side of the AAR as well. The tape and chalk worked, and even though the bar tore me the fuck up, it also got me 700 additional pull-ups, so I was headed in the right direction. Another positive was the support of Nandor's CrossFit community. It felt great to be surrounded by such intense, respectful people. But this time, I'd need to cut the number of volunteers in half. I wanted as little buzz in that room as possible. After listing out all the pluses, it was time to kick the tires on my mindset. And if you're doing your post-faceplant due diligence, you should do that too. That means checking yourself on how and what you were thinking during the preparation and execution phases of your failure. My commitment to preparation and determination in the fight are always there. They didn't waver. But my belief was shakier than I cared to admit. And as I prepared for my third go-round, it was imperative to move beyond doubt. That wasn't easy, because after my second failure in as many attempts, the doubters were everywhere online. The record holder, Stephen Hyland, was light and spidery strong, with thick, muscular palms. He was the perfect build for the pull-up record, and everyone was telling me I was just too big, my form was too brutal, and that I should stop trying to go for it before I hurt myself even worse. They pointed to the scoreboard that doesn't lie. I was still over 800 pull-ups away from the record. That's more than I gained between my first and second attempts. From the beginning, some of them had predicted my hands would give out. And when that truth revealed itself in Nashville, it presented a big mental hurdle. Part of me wondered if those motherfuckers were right, if I was trying to achieve the impossible. Then I thought of an English middle-distance runner from back in the day named Roger Bannister. When Bannister was trying to break the 4-minute mile in the 1950s, experts told him it couldn't be done, but that didn't stop him. He failed again and again, but he persevered, and when he ran his historic mile in 3 minutes 59 seconds and 4-tenths of a second on May 6, 1954, he didn't just break a record. He broke open the floodgates simply by proving it possible. 6 weeks later, his record was eclipsed. And by now, over 1,000 runners have done what was once thought to be beyond human capability. We are all guilty of allowing so-called experts, or just people who have more experience in a given field than we do, to cap our potential. One of the reasons we love sports is because we also love watching those glass ceilings get shattered. If I was going to be the next athlete to smash popular perception, I'd need to stop listening to doubt, whether it streamed in from the outside or bubbled up from within. And the best way to do that was to decide that the pull-up record was already mine. I didn't know when it would officially become mine. It might be in 2 months or 20 years. But once I decided it belonged to me and decoupled it from the calendar, I was filled with confidence and relieved of any and all pressure because my task morphed from trying to achieve the impossible into working toward the inevitable. But to get there, I'd have to find the tactical advantage I'd been missing. A tactical review is the final and most vital piece of any live autopsy, or AAR. And while I had improved tactically from the first attempt, working on a more stable bar and minimizing wasted energy, I still fell 800 reps short, so we needed to dive deeper into the numbers. 6 pull-ups per minute on the minute had failed me twice. Yes, it placed me on a fast track to 4,020, but I never got there. This time, I decided to start slower to go further. I also knew from experience that I would hit some sort of wall after 10 hours, and that my response couldn't be a longer break. The 10-hour mark smacked me in the face twice, and both times I stopped for 5 minutes or longer, which led to ultimate failure pretty quickly. I needed to stay true to my strategy and limit any long breaks to 4 minutes max. Now, about that pull-up bar. Yeah, it would probably tear me up again, so I needed to find a workaround. According to the rules, I wouldn't be allowed to switch up the distance between my hands mid-attempt. The width would have to remain the same from the first pull-up. The only thing I could change would be how I was going to protect my hands. In the run-up to my third attempt, I experimented with all different types of gloves. I also got clearance to use custom foam pads to protect my palms. I remembered seeing a couple of SEAL buddies use slices of foam mattresses to protect their hands when they were lifting heavy weights, and called on a mattress company to custom design form-fitting pads for my hands. Guinness approved the equipment, and at 10 a.m. on January 19, 2013, 2 months after failing for the second time, I was back on the bar at CrossFit Brentwood Hills. I started slow and easy, with 5 pull-ups on the minute. I didn't strap my foam pads with tape. I just held them in place around the bar, and they seemed to work well. Within an hour, the foam had formed around my hands, insulating them from molten iron hell. Or so I fucking hoped. At around the 2-hour, 600-rep mark, I asked Nandor to play Going the Distance on a loop. I felt something click inside and went full cyborg. I found a rhythm on the bar, and between sets, I sat on a weight bench and stared at the chalk-dusted floor. My point of view narrowed into tunnel vision as I prepared my mind for the hell that was to come. When the first blister opened on my palm, I knew shit was about to get real. But this time, thanks to my failures and forensics, I was ready. That doesn't mean I was having any fun. I wasn't. I was over it. I didn't want to do pull-ups anymore. But achieving goals or overcoming obstacles doesn't have to be fun. Seeds burst from the inside out in a self-destructive ritual of new life. Does that sound like fucking fun? Like it feels good? I wasn't in that gym to get happy or do what I wanted to be doing. I was there to turn myself inside out, if that's what it took, to blast through any and all mental, emotional, and physical barriers. After 12 hours, I finally hit 3,000 pull-ups, a major checkpoint for me, and felt like I'd run headfirst into a wall. I was exasperated, in agony, and my hands were starting to come apart again. I was still a long way from the record, and I felt all the eyeballs in the room upon me. With them came the crushing weight of failure and humiliation. Suddenly, I was back in the cage during my third hell week, taping my shins and ankles before mustering up with a new buds class who'd heard it was my last chance. It takes great strength to be vulnerable enough to put your ass on the line, in public, and work toward a dream that feels like it's slipping away. We all have eyeballs on us. Our family and friends are watching. And even if you're surrounded by positive people, they will have ideas about who you are, what you're good at, and how you should focus your energy. That shit is just human nature. And if you try to break out of their box, you'll get some unsolicited advice that has a way of smothering your aspirations if you let it. Often, our people don't mean any harm. Nobody who cares about us actually wants us to get hurt. They want us to be safe, comfortable, and happy, and not to have to stare at the floor in a dungeon, sifting through shards of our broken dreams. Too bad. There's a lot of potential in those moments of pain. And if you figure out how to piece that picture back together, you'll find a hell of a lot of power there, too. I kept my break to just 4 minutes as planned, long enough to stuff my hands and those foam pads into a pair of padded gloves. But when I got back on the bar, I felt slow and weak. Nandor and his wife and the other volunteers saw my struggle, but they left me the fuck alone to put in my earbuds, channel Rocky Balboa, and keep grinding one rep at a time. I went from 4 pull-ups on the minute to 3 and found my cyborg trance again. I went ugly. I got dark. I imagined my pain was the creation of a mad scientist named Stephen Hyland, the evil genius who was in temporary possession of my record and my soul. It was him. That motherfucker was torturing me from across the globe, and it was up to me, and only me, to keep piling up numbers and steamroll toward him, if I wanted to take his motherfucking soul. To be clear, I wasn't angry with Hyland. I don't even know him. I went there to find the edge I needed to keep going. I got personal with him in my head, not out of overconfidence or envy, but to drown out my own doubt. Life is a head game. This was just the latest angle I used to win a game within that game. I had to find an edge somewhere, and if you find it in the person standing in your way, that's potent. As the hours ticked past midnight, I started closing the distance between us, but the pull-ups weren't coming fast, and they weren't coming easy. I was tired mentally and physically, deep into rhabdo, and I was down to 3 pull-ups a minute. When I hit 3,800 pull-ups, I felt like I could see the mountaintop. I also knew it was possible to go from being able to do 3 pull-ups to no pull-ups in a flash. There are stories of people at Badwater who reached mile 129 and couldn't finish a 135-mile race. You never know when you'll reach your 100% and hit the point of total muscle fatigue. I kept waiting for that moment to come when I couldn't pick my arms up anymore. Doubt stalked me like a shadow. I tried my best to control it or silence it, yet it kept reappearing, following me, pushing me. After 17 hours of pain, around 3 a.m. on January 20th, 2013, I did my 4,020th and 4,021st pull-up, and the record was mine. Everyone in the gym cheered, but I stayed composed. After 2 more sets and 4,030 total pull-ups, I took my headphones out, stared into the camera, and said, "I tracked you down, Stephen Hyland." In one day, I'd lifted the equivalent of 846,030 pounds, nearly 3 times the weight of the space shuttle. Cheers spread to laughter as I pulled off my gloves and disappeared into the back room, but much to everyone's surprise, I was not in the mood to celebrate. Does that shock you too? You know that my refrigerator is never full, and it never will be, because I live a mission-driven life, always on the hunt for the next challenge. That mindset is the reason I broke that record, finished Badwater, became a SEAL, rocked Ranger School, and on down the list. In my mind, I'm that racehorse, always chasing a carrot I'll never catch, forever trying to prove myself to myself. And when you live that way and attain a goal, success feels anticlimactic. Unlike my initial shot at the record, my success barely made a ripple in the news cycle, which was just fine. I wasn't doing it for adulation. I raised some money, and I learned all I could from that pull-up bar. After logging more than 67,000 pull-ups in 9 months, it was time to put them in my cookie jar and move on. Because life is one long motherfucking imaginary game that has no scoreboard, no referee, and isn't over until we're dead and buried. And all I'd ever wanted from it was to become successful in my own eyes. That didn't mean wealth or celebrity, a garage full of hot cars, or a harem of beautiful women trailing after me. It meant becoming the hardest motherfucker who ever lived. Sure, I stacked up some failures along the way, but in my mind, the record proved that I was close. Only the game wasn't over, and being hard came with a requirement to drain every drop of ability from my mind, body, and soul before the whistle blew. I would remain in constant pursuit. I wouldn't leave anything on the table. I wanted to earn my final resting place. That's how I thought back then anyway, because I had no clue how close to the end I already was. Man.
The chills just came on me, brother.
All right. Well, dude, congratulations. I mean, that's amazing. You were on that mission. You weren't going to be denied.
You know what? It was funny about that. If people, you know, those people who are listening to this book, man, this was all a process. And what happens when you get to chapter 10, you forget chapter 1, 2, and 3.
Yeah, it's true.
At the place I was at. So now you start looking at where I'm at now. Don't forget where I started. Don't forget where my mindset was. I was a cheating guy that got called, you know, that got called nigger all the time. Dad beat the hell out of me. My mom was always gone working, living in a $7 a month place. I struggled. That was my foundation. That was my base. So to take that base, that foundation, once again, don't put a title on me. It is possible to achieve when you want to dissect and do a live autopsy on your brain and figure out what makes me tick. You have to figure that out. So don't forget all that. And another thing that's important here is during this time, Adam, everything I did, self-talk is so important.
Mm.
And a lot of people write books on self-talk,
yep.
Visualization, all that stuff. It's not that easy. It's not that easy. As you see here in the last couple paragraphs, I did 67,000 pull-ups in 9 months. What happened to me when things were getting really hard, I mean, all the time, but especially on this last record attempt when I finally got it, when I got to about 3,500, I was terrified. I thought for sure, man, because I knew how fast muscle failure happens.
Cause, right.
I mean, I have two contact points. They're my hands. And once those arms give out, man, you're done. It can happen at any pull-up at any time when when you're that deep into the dungeon.
Yeah, you could never get comfortable. It could happen at any moment.
At any moment, especially when you're 35,000, I mean 3,500 reps in.
Hell yeah.
Which is like, what, 700 and some odd thousand pounds.
You were already beyond known territory, so
right.
At any moment it could happen.
So I was freaking out, so I went deep. That's why I had to put the earbuds in.
Yeah.
And kind of channel everything out and go within my own mind. And a lot of folks think it's just as easy as just talking to yourself. That's what self-talk is. No, that's you lying to yourself.
Yeah.
If you haven't put the actual work in, I was remembering the 67,000 pull-ups it took for me to get to this moment. That was my self-talk. It was those days in the gym where I cranked out 2,000 pull-ups. It was those, you know, everyday grind on that pull-up bar. So when things got really bad for me, I went back into the mindset, into the dungeon of all those hours and months on the pull-up bar.
Yeah, well, you knew you could do it. I mean, I go swimming, quarter mile offshore, all the time, to this reef out off Malibu. And, when I take people out there, before I take them out there, I usually ask them to do like 1,000 yards in a pool nonstop.
Right.
Because when they're off a quarter mile to a half mile offshore, that shit looks far.
Right.
And you need to know, you need to have that. I don't care if they swam it fast. I just want them to know in their own heads, hey, I've swam farther this without stopping before.
That's a true
story. So I can
man.
Do this. So that's, it's all just for having those reps, right?
You know what? It's all about repetition. And that's what failure is about. Failure kind of sets that bar. And then you go, okay, next time out, I'm going past where I failed.
Mm.
And it's a new bar.
Yeah.
Now you're going to fail again. But failing doesn't mean you quit. It means you failed, but get back up and continue to push that bar higher and higher and higher. And with that knowledge, that newfound knowledge, you can then make that failure a huge success.
Failure doesn't mean you're a failure. It means you failed at one thing, one time.
That's all it means,
and it could be the 10th time you did it one time, but it's still just that one thing.
You know what? In a lot of things that you're failing at, some people have never even tried.
Right.
And so people look at that, oh my God, I'm failing, and they look at it and they get all consumed with this shit. And that's all it is, man. Stop looking at it like some big failure. A lot of people aren't even trying what you're trying to do, and it's your life. Stop competing with the world. And no one really gives a shit. Everybody's lives are so consumed with paying bills and their husband or wives and their kids. No one cares as much as you do. Trust me. It's not as bad as you think.
What I love in this chapter also, though, that can be really applied to anything are the after-action reports. So I know that's this challenge. So I'm going to read through the challenge, and then maybe we can talk just a couple minutes a little bit more about your after-action report discipline and why it's important.
Roger that.
Challenge 10. Think about your most recent and your most heart-wrenching failures. Break out that journal one last time. Log off the digital version and write them out longhand. I want you to feel this process because you are about to file your own belated after-action reports. First off, write out all the good things, everything that went well from your failures. Be detailed and generous with yourself. A lot of good things will have happened. It's rarely all bad. Then note how you handled your failure. Did it affect your life and your relationships? How so? How did you think throughout the preparation for and during the execution stage of your failure? You have to know how you were thinking at each step because it's all about mindset, and that's where most people fall short. Now, go back through and make a list of things you can fix. This isn't time to be soft or generous. Be brutally honest. Write them all out. Study them. Then look at your calendar and schedule another attempt as soon as possible. If the failure happened in childhood and you can't recreate the Little League All-Star game you choked in, I still want you to write that report because you'll likely be able to use that information to achieve any goal going forward. As you prepare, keep that AAR handy. Consult your accountability mirror and make all necessary adjustments. When it comes time to execute, keep everything we've learned about the power of a callous mind, the cookie jar, and the 40% rule in the forefront of your mind. Control your mindset. Dominate your thought process. This life is all a fucking mind game. Realize that. Own it. And if you fail again, so the fuck be it. Take the pain, repeat these steps, and keep fighting. That's what it's all about. Share your stories from preparation, training, and execution on social media with the hashtags, hashtag can't hurt me, hashtag empowerment of failure. You know, I just love this idea of going back through the old failures.
Right.
Whether they're recent or long time ago. I mean, I'll just say it right here. This Little League thing is my deal. You know, that's what happened to me. I made an error that cost us the game and kicked us out of the Little League tournament. And I know how I handled it. I knew my mindset going in. I mean, I was a little kid. It's easy to let a little kid off the hook, but that coach had never believed in me. You know, I was an all-star because I did well that whole year. I was one of the best players, but that coach, for whatever reason, I was a small kid, didn't believe in me. And I let that mess with my game.
Right.
And then after the fact, I definitely let that affect my entire summer. Like, my summer was fucking gone. You know, and as a kid, you're resilient by nature, but I never fully let it go because I always was so ashamed.
Well, I'll tell you something, and we talked about it during this whole book process was my very last basketball game, my senior year. Very last basketball game, man. I had a chance to win the game. There was 18 or 17 seconds on the clock. We were up by 1 point, and I'm at the foul line. It was I had a one-on-one, so took the shot, missed it, hit the front iron. They got the ball. I was guarding the best offensive player in the state of Indiana. I was the best defensive player, and he came down the court, And literally, he threw up this three-pointer. I was probably about 2 feet from him. I was straight up in the air, and there's an article out there called The Phantom Foul. I was about 2 feet from him. He tried to lean into me, never touched me, shot a hook shot from the three-point line, top of the key. It didn't go in. We got the rebound, and I heard a whistle. And they called me for the foul. He hit three free throws. They won the game. That was my very last basketball game I ever played, and that's how it ended. That's how it ended. And all I had in high school pretty much was basketball. And one thing about all this AAR stuff, life isn't always going to be fun.
No.
It is not always. We are looking, you know, we're in a time right now where everybody wants to be happy all the time. All the time. You're not always going to be happy. And life isn't always going to be fun. There's a time where you need to go into a dark place in a nice dark room and be brutally honest with who you are to get better. And that's what the whole after action report is. It's okay to be alone. Don't always have to be around people. Be alone in your own thoughts and really kind of break yourself down systematically. Figure out your weak points and then make those weak points your strong points.
Well, what I love about the AAR though is because you're going to be, when life isn't fun and you don't have the tools though, and you're locked in this kind of negative mental health space.
Right.
If you're without the tools, it can just snowball on you fast. But the AAR is actually a tool.
That's right.
So you're not alone. You're alone with tools.
That's right.
And that's a lot different. And then you can kind of whittle it down. And then by the time you come back out of that, you actually have ownership. Just like you're always saying, you got to own it. It's your life to own. It's your shit to own. The good shit and the bad shit. And what I love about this is, you know, there's good stuff. Like if I was a 12-year-old kid, you know, for you, it's like, shit, I was the best defensive player. That's good. You know, I got to the line. That's good.
Right.
So there's all these things that are positives, and that's how you lead it. So I think this is a really, really helpful tool. I never hear anybody talk about it. I really encourage this. I personally am getting into it. I love it. And I think it's a tool. You're not alone in your failure. You actually have tools to use.
Well, the whole thing about being alone is that you cannot have these people around you patting on your back saying, it's okay.
Right.
We don't need to try it again.
Right.
You know, that's the whole thing about it, man. It's about you owning this.
That's what I mean. Not that it's bad to be alone, but that you're alone
this.
With tools.
That's right.
You're alone in the fucking in the laboratory.
But the
with
thing
tools.
About it is that we all have the tools.
Yeah.
But we are so in a poopy pants mentality that we forget that we have tools.
Well, you've given them with this AR.
Oh.
This is a tool. So
these are all barbaric tools, man. None of this stuff is like, you know, groundbreaking stuff.
This is the stone tools.
That's it, man. My whole thinking process, you know, this isn't like, you know, I went to Harvard or Yale. Everything I've done in my life is some old school barbarian, you know, stuff that we've been, it's in us.
You went to Knuckle Dragger University.
That's it, man. It is in us. This is how we act. This is how we are, but we don't want to do this stuff. This is Knuckle Dragger University. This is true. The school of hard knocks. And that's all it is. It's, once you look at it, it's in there, man. It's in there.
Chapter 11. What if? Before the race even kicked off, I knew I was fucked. In 2014, the National Park Service wouldn't approve the traditional Badwater course. So Chris Kossman redrew the map. Instead of starting in Death Valley National Park and running 42 miles through the hottest desert on the planet, it would launch further up country at the base of a 22-mile climb. That wasn't my problem. It was the fact that I towed the line 11 pounds over my usual race weight and had gained 10 of those pounds in the previous 7 days. I wasn't a fat ass. To the average eye, I looked fit. But Badwater wasn't an average race. To run and finish strong, my condition needed to be tip-top, and I was far from it. Whatever was happening to me came as a shock, because after 2 years of substandard running, I thought I'd gotten my powers back. The previous January, I'd won a 100-kilometer glacial trail race called Frozen Otter. It wasn't as hard as the Hurt 100, but it was close. Set in Wisconsin, just outside Milwaukee, the course laid out like a lopsided figure eight, with the start-finish at the center. We passed it between the two loops, which enabled us to stock up on food and other necessary supplies from our cars, and stuff them into our packs with our emergency supplies. The weather can turn evil out there. and race organizers compiled a list of necessities we were required to have on us at all times so we wouldn't die of dehydration, hypothermia, or exposure. The first lap was a larger loop of the two, and when we set off, the temperature was sitting at 0 degrees Fahrenheit. Those trails were never plowed. In some places, snow piled into drifts. In others, the trails seemed purposefully glazed with slick ice, which presented a problem because I wasn't wearing boots or trail shoes like most of my competitors. I laced up my standard running shoes and tucked them into some cheap-ass crampons, which theoretically were supposed to grip the ice and keep me upright. Well, the ice won that war, and my crampons snapped off in the first hour. Nevertheless, I was leading the race and breaking trail in an average of 6 to 12 inches of snow. In some places, the drifts were piled much higher. My feet were cold and wet from the starting gun, and within 2 hours they felt frozen through, especially my toes. My top half wasn't faring much better. When you sweat in below freezing temperature, salt on your body chafes the skin. My underarms and chest were cracking raspberry red. I was covered in rashes. My toes hurt with every step, but none of that registered too high on my pain scale because I was running free. For the first time since my second heart surgery, my body was beginning to put itself back together. I was getting 100% of my oxygen supply like everyone else. My endurance and strength were next level, and though the trail was a slippery mess, my technique was dialed in too. I was way out front and stopped at my car for a sandwich before the last 22-mile loop. My toes throbbed with evil pain. I suspected they were frostbitten, which meant I was in danger of losing some of them, but I didn't want to take off my shoes and look. Once again, doubt and fear were popping in my brain, reminding me that only a handful of people had ever finished the Frozen Otter, and that no lead was safe in that kind of cold. Weather, more than any other variable, can break a motherfucker down quick. But I didn't listen to any of that. I created a new dialogue and told myself to finish the race strong and worry about amputated toes at the hospital after I was crowned champion. I ran back onto the course. A blast of sun had melted some of the snow earlier in the day, but the cold wind iced up the trail nicely. As I ran, I flashed to my first year at Hurt 100 and the great Carl Meltzer. Back then, I was a plodder. I hit the turf with my heel first, and peeling the muddy trail with the entire surface area of my foot increased my odds of slipping and falling. Carl didn't run like that. He moved like a goat, bouncing on his toes and running along the edges of the trail. As soon as his toes hit the ground, he fired his legs into the air. That's why he looked like he was floating. By design, he barely touched the ground, while his head and core remained stable and engaged. From that moment onward, his movements were permanently etched in my brain like a cave painting. I visualized them all the time and put his techniques into practice during training runs. They say it takes 66 days to build a habit. For me, it takes a hell of a lot longer than that, but I eventually get there. And during all those years of ultra running and competition, I was working on my craft. A true runner analyzes their form. We didn't learn how to do that in the SEALs, but being around so many ultra runners for years, I was able to absorb and practice skills that seemed unnatural at first. At Frozen Otter, my main focus was to hit the ground soft, to touch it just enough to explode. During my third Buds class, and then my first platoon, when I was considered one of the better runners, my head bounced all over the place. My weight wasn't balanced, and when my foot hit the ground, all my weight would be supported by that one leg, which led to some awkward falls on slippery terrain. Through trial and error, and thousands of hours of training, I learned to maintain balance. At Frozen Otter, it all came together. With speed and grace, I navigated steep, slippery trails. I kept my head flat and still, my motion quiet as possible, and my steps silent by running on the front of my feet. When I picked up speed, it was as if I'd disappeared into a white wind, elevated into a meditative state. I became Carl Meltzer. Now it was me who looked to be levitating over an impossible trail, and I finished the race in 16 hours, smashing the course record and winning the Frozen Otter title without losing any toes. 2 years earlier, I was stricken with dizzy spells during easy 6-mile runs. In 2013, I was forced to walk over 100 miles of bad water and finished in 17th place. I'd been on a downslide and thought my days of contention for titles were long past over. After Frozen Otter, I was tempted to believe I'd made it all the way back and then some, and that my best ultra years were actually ahead of me. I took that energy into my preparations for Badwater 2014. I was living in Chicago at the time, working as an instructor in Buds Prep, a school that prepared candidates to deal with the harsh reality they would face in Buds. After more than 20 years, I was in my final year of military service, and by being placed in a position to drop wisdom on the would-bes and wannabes, it felt like I'd come full circle. As usual, I would run 10 miles to work and back, and squeeze in another 8 miles during lunch when I could. On the weekends, I'd do at least one 35 to 40 mile run. It all added up to a succession of 130 mile weeks, and I was feeling strong. As spring bloomed, I added a heat training component by slipping on 4 or 5 layers of sweats, a beanie, and a Gore-Tex jacket before hitting the streets. When I'd show up at work, my fellow SEAL instructors would watch, amazed, as I peeled off my wet clothes and stuffed them into black trash bags that together weighed nearly 15 pounds. You know, David, I gotta stop, dude. Every time I hear you in your 4 layers of clothes and a fucking beanie, dude.
Right.
In the summertime.
Dude, looking crazy.
I mean, that is absolutely mental. I can only imagine. Like, people must have thought you'd lost your mind.
Well, I'm not, so the thing about it is I was on some of the busiest streets. So it wasn't like I was hiding out. So, you know, you see this guy running in like 4 or 5 layers of sweatpants. And I had a hoodie with a beanie. And I guarantee you, man, I was getting some crazy looks. I just didn't look at anybody. I just kept on running.
Did you prefer training in Chicago to training in Nyland? Did some part of you like training in California? Was it better to train in California because it was a more kind of apt place to train given the terrain?
California, Nyland was medieval.
Yeah.
Cause it was damn near Death Valley.
Right.
You know, it was like 110, 115 degrees.
Yeah.
So I would go out there wearing all those layers and it was almost exactly like, you know, Death Valley. In Chicago, there was times in the summertime, it'd be like 69 degrees.
Right.
So I'm running thinking, man, I'm not even getting, you know, I'm not getting good training in.
Hmm.
So it was very difficult, but I swear to God, I'd get to work and I would sit there and I would get a trash can and I would be in my office. And I had a guy there with me, another SEAL, and I would sit there and just wring out these clothes. He'd be like, oh my God, dude. It'd be like literally that trash can would be full of water.
Did you like to do it in front of the Buds Prep guys so they could see you and just like get scared?
You know what's crazy about that? I actually hid a lot of that from them. But one thing I didn't hide was during the Frozen Otter, I actually got done with that race and we actually called all the Buds Prep in. About 12 o'clock, had a surprise inspection. It was like midnight. Had a surprise inspection. It was the day after I just got through doing the Frozen Otter. And there's a picture in the book of my toe after, or my feet after Frozen Otter. And I walked around with sandals on. And so they were in the leaning rest position. So, you know, doing push-ups. So my feet were right by their face. And my feet smell like hell because they're all infected and shit. So I made sure I said, hey, get down on there, buddy. Jump on down, smell that toe, boy. Jump on down, smell that toe. So, you know, you have fun with them a little bit, man. But yeah, I had some ugly feet, man. The toenails are coming off. The blood was everywhere. And the picture's disgusting. So yeah, it was a good time.
That's funny. So you're on track. You're feeling good. And here we'll go back in. I started my taper 4 weeks out and went from 130 mile weeks to an 80 mile week, then down to 60, 40, and 20. Tapering is supposed to generate an abundance of energy as you eat and rest, enabling the body to repair all the damage done and get you primed for competition. Instead, I never felt worse. I wasn't hungry and couldn't sleep at all. Some people said my body was starved of calories. Others suggested I might be low on sodium. My doctor measured my thyroid, and it was a little off, but the readings weren't so bad to explain how shitty I felt. Perhaps the explanation was simple, that I was overtrained. 2 weeks before the race, I considered pulling out. I worried it was my heart again, because on easy runs, I felt a surge of adrenaline that I couldn't vent. Even a mellow pace sent my pulse racing into arrhythmia. 10 days before the race, I landed in Vegas. I'd scheduled 5 runs, but couldn't get past the 3-mile mark on any of them. I wasn't eating that much, but the weight kept piling on. It was all water. I sought out another doctor who confirmed there was nothing physically wrong with me, And when I heard that, I was not about to be a pussy. During the opening miles, an initial climb of Badwater 2014, my heart rate ran high, but part of that was the altitude, and 22 miles later, I made it to the top in 6th or 7th place. Surprised and proud, I thought, let's see if I can go downhill. I've never enjoyed the brutality of running down a steep incline, because it shreds the quads. But I also thought it would allow me to reset and calm my breath. My body refused. I couldn't catch my breath at all. I hit the flat section at the bottom, slowed my pace, and began to walk. My competitors passed me by as my thighs twitched uncontrollably. My muscle spasms were so bad, my quads looked like there was an alien rattling around inside them. And still I didn't stop. I walked for 4 full miles before seeking shelter in a Lone Pine motel room, where the Badwater medical team had set up shop. They checked me out and saw that my blood pressure was a bit low, but easily corrected. They couldn't find a single metric that could explain how fucked I felt. I ate some solid food, rested, and decided to try one more time. There was a flat section leaving Lone Pine, and I thought if I could knock that out, perhaps I'd catch a second wind. But 6 or 7 miles later, my sails were still empty, and I'd given all I had. My muscles trembled and twitched. My heart jumped up and down the chart. I looked over at my pacer and said, "That's it, man. I'm done." My support vehicle pulled up behind us and I climbed inside. A few minutes later, I was laying on that same motel bed with my tail between my legs. I'd lasted just 50 miles, but any humiliation that came with quitting, not something I was used to, was drowned out by an instinct that something was way the fuck off. It wasn't my fear talking or my desire for comfort. This time, I was certain that if I didn't stop trying to break through this barrier, I wouldn't make it out of the Sierras alive. We left Lone Pine for Las Vegas the next night, and for 2 days I did my best to rest and recover, hoping my body would settle somewhere close to equilibrium. We were staying at the Wynn, and on that third morning I went for a jog to see if I had anything in a tank. 1 mile later, my heart was in my throat, and I shut it down. I walked back to the hotel, knowing that despite what the doctor said, I was sick, and suspected that whatever I had was serious. Later that night, after seeing a movie in the Vegas suburbs, I felt weak as we strolled to a nearby restaurant, the Elephant Bar. My mom was a few paces ahead, and I saw her in triplicate. I clenched my eyes shut, released them, and there were still 3 of her. She held the door open for me, and when I stepped into the cool confines, I felt a bit better. We slid into a booth opposite one another. I was too unsteady to read the menu and asked her to order for me. From there, it got worse. And when the runner showed up with our food, my vision blurred again. I strained to open my eyes wide and felt woozy as my mother looked to be floating above the table. "You're going to have to call an ambulance," I said, "because I'm going down." Desperate for some stability, I laid my head on the table, but my mom didn't dial 911. She crossed to my side, and I leaned on her as we made our way to the hostess stand and then back to the car. On the way, I shared as much of my medical history as I could recall in short bursts, in case I lost consciousness and she did have to call for help. Luckily, my vision and energy improved enough for her to drive me to the emergency room herself. My thyroid had been flagged in the past, so that's the first thing the doctors explored. Many Navy SEALs have thyroid issues when they reach their 30s, because when you put motherfuckers in extreme environments like Hell Week and war, their hormone levels go haywire. When the thyroid gland is suboptimal, fatigue, muscle aches, and weakness are among more than a dozen major side effects. But my thyroid levels were close to normal. My heart checked out too. The ER docs in Vegas told me all I needed was rest. I went back to Chicago and saw my own doctor, who ordered a battery of blood tests. His office tested my endocrine system and screened me for Lyme, hepatitis, rheumatoid arthritis, and a handful of other autoimmune diseases. Everything came back clean except for my thyroid, which was slightly suboptimal. But that didn't explain how I'd morphed so fast from an elite athlete capable of running hundreds of miles into a pretender who could barely muster the energy to tie his shoes, let alone run a mile without verging on collapse. I was in medical no man's land. I left his office with more questions than answers and a prescription for thyroid medication. Each day that went by, I felt worse. Everything was crashing on me. I had trouble getting out of bed. I was constipated and achy. They took more blood and decided I had Addison's disease, an autoimmune illness that occurs when your adrenals are drained and your body doesn't produce enough cortisol, which was common in SEALs because we're primed to run on adrenaline. My doctor prescribed the steroid hydrocortisone, DHEA, and Arimidex, among other meds. But taking his pills only accelerated my decline. And after that, he and the other doctors I saw were tapped out. The look in their eyes said it all. In their minds, I was either a crazy hypochondriac or I was dying, and they didn't know what was killing me or how to heal me. I fought through it the best I could. My coworkers didn't know anything about my decline because I continued to show no weakness. My whole life, I'd been hiding all my insecurities and trauma. I kept all my vulnerabilities locked down beneath an iron veneer. But eventually the pain became so bad, I couldn't even get out of bed. I called in sick and lay there, staring at the ceiling, and wondered, could this be the end? Peering into the abyss sent my mind reeling back through the days, weeks, years, like fingers flipping through old files. I found all the best parts and tacked them together into a highlight loop, streamed on repeat. I grew up beat down and abused, filtered uneducated through a system that rejected me at every turn, until I took ownership and started to change. Since then, I'd been obese. I was married and divorced. I had 2 heart surgeries, taught myself to swim, and learned to run on broken legs. I was terrified of heights, then took up high-altitude skydiving. Water scared the living shit out of me, yet I became a technical diver, an underwater navigator, which is several degrees of difficulty beyond scuba diving. I competed in more than 60 ultra-distance races, winning several, and set a pull-up record. I stuttered through my early years in primary school and grew up to become the Navy SEAL's most trusted public speaker. I'd served my country on the battlefield. Along the way, I became driven to make sure that I could not be defined by the abuse I was born into or the bullying I grew up with. I wouldn't be defined by talent either. I didn't have much, or my own fears and weaknesses. I was the sum total of the obstacles I'd overcome, and even though I told my story to students all over the country, I never stopped long enough to appreciate the tale I told or the life I'd built. In my mind, I didn't have the time to waste. I never hit snooze on my life clock because there was always something else to do. If I worked a 20-hour day, I'd work out for an hour and sleep for 3, but I made sure to get that motherfucker in. My brain wasn't wired to appreciate. It was programmed to do work, scan the horizon, ask what's next, and get it done. That's why I piled up so many rare feats. I was always on the hunt for the next big thing. But as I lay there in bed, my body taut with tension and throbbing with pain, I had a clear idea what was next for me. The cemetery. After years of abuse, I'd finally shredded my physical body beyond repair. I was dying. For weeks and months, I searched for a cure to my medical mystery. But in that moment of catharsis, I didn't feel sad, and I didn't feel cheated. I was only 38 years old, but I'd lived 10 lives and experienced a hell of a lot more than most 80-year-olds. I wasn't feeling sorry for myself. It made sense that at some point the toll would come due. I spent hours reflecting back on my journey. This time, I wasn't sifting through the cookie jar while in the heat of battle, hoping to find a ticket to victory. I wasn't leveraging my life assets towards some new end. No, I was done fighting, and all I felt was gratitude. I wasn't meant to be this person. I had to fight myself at every turn, and my destroyed body was my biggest trophy. In that moment, I knew it didn't matter if I ever ran again, if I couldn't operate anymore, or if I lived or died. And with that acceptance came deep appreciation. My eyes welled with tears, not because I was afraid, but because at my lowest point, I found clarity. The kid I always judged so harshly didn't lie and cheat to hurt anyone's feelings. He did it for acceptance. He broke the rules because he didn't have the tools to compete and was ashamed for being dumb. He did it because he needed friends. I was afraid to tell the teachers I couldn't read. I was terrified of the stigma associated with special education. And instead of coming down on that kid for one more second, instead of chastising my younger self, I understood him for the first time. It was a lonely journey from there to here. I missed out on so much. I didn't have a lot of fun.